Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 19th, 2012. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, Andy Sparks and I talk about the beginning of a new adventure, bourbon barrel beer. Andy's purchased a small barrel and will strategize on what exactly we're going to do with it. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can also find our 2012 Brewer's Logbooks, which will help you log and track up to 50 batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again, everybody, for clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us first and click on our associate link. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show. We greatly appreciate the support of those who have been doing that. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, too, and we're on the Stitcher app as well. I've been looking at my two fermenters that I have going in the basement there with my Belgian Amber that I brewed as part of the Brew Your Own Magazine Basic Brewing Radio collaborative experiment on secondary fermenters. Surprising results so far. Surprising to me, at least. I don't want to spoil it for you, though. I'm planning to brew up another batch and repeat the experiment to make sure I'm not seeing an anomaly, and I hope that you are participating too. The deadline is May 21st, and what I did was I split a batch of beer, split a batch of wort, and I kept one in the primary fermenter, and I've racked the second one to a secondary after primary fermentation was complete, and I'm tracking the results. Very cool. Let's take a look into the mailbag before we talk about barrels with Andy. Jim from Brookings, South Dakota writes, most recipes say cool wort as soon as possible, but nothing else. I assume to get it to a 70 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit, but would like to know more about ASAP. It's somewhat obvious, but I find myself rushing and messing up more. I even read one place. It said chill overnight. I know bad things can happen, as in contaminants, chemicals, etc. Just want to know a realistic time to chill. Well, Jim, if you're rushing and messing things up, maybe it's you who needs to chill. You, if you're messing things up, maybe you need to slow down. Frankly, you sound a lot like me when I was first starting to brew. I remember when I brewed my first couple of batches, I brewed by myself, and I had never seen anybody brew before in person. And I remember Andy being on the other end of the phone several times as I was calling him up, and I was saying, "This is happening, Andy. Should this be happening? What do I do now? Did I do that right? Have I ruined my beer, or you know, something like that?" But the truth is that beer is pretty forgiving, and you can find out that you can kind of chill out and, you know, try to follow the rules as much as you can, try to follow the recipe as much as you can. But, as long as you get your equipment and everything that touches the beer after you chill it sanitized, you're probably in pretty good shape. Now, as a general guideline, I like to chill my worts, especially on American pale ales, in as close to half an hour as I can. But it's not because I'm worried about the beer being ruined by infection in that short time space. I'm more concerned about preserving the fresh hop flavors that may be degraded by the heat over time. So that's a general guideline on my part. But, you know, no-chill brewers, they pour their hot wort into plastic containers and seal them up, and then the wort is allowed to cool on its own inside that sealed container. And brewers years back, and even now, cool their wort naturally in big, shallow fermenters called cool ships. So it's just allowed to cool naturally over time. My point is this. As long as you don't do something like, you know, leave the lid off your kettle and dust the shelves over the kettle while the beer is chilling, there's probably no need to panic. Just try to keep the kettle covered and chill as best you can. And once you get a few batches under your belt, literally and figuratively, you'll feel more confident about your processes, and you'll not panic so much. You don't need to panic. Somebody said, relax, don't worry, something. Relax, don't worry, have a homebrew, Charlie Papazian says. Another new brewer Norm writes in with this, which is a bit of a puzzle. Norm says, I was watching one of your old videos where you guys were talking about session beers, beers that had an overall low ABV, or alcohol by volume. You guys mentioned something about how you can have a relatively low starting gravity but still end up with a high ABV if your efficiency is good, even though that was not your intended purpose. I'm considering making a mean barley wine, and I just wanted some clarification on how to get good efficiency so my ABV ends up where I need it. Do you recommend a high specific gravity, or am I missing the point? Well, here's what I wrote back to Norm. I said, I think you may be confusing efficiency with attenuation. It seems like you're referring to the episode about the beer that I brewed with Maris Otter malt and my efficiency. In other words, the amount of sugars that I got from the mash tun was good. So good that I wound up with a higher specific gravity wort than I had expected. Attenuation is basically the difference between the original gravity and the final gravity of the beer before and after fermentation. Measuring the difference between those two gives you your alcohol by volume. Now, if you're brewing a barley wine and you get good efficiency from your mash tun, then you'll get a high specific gravity for your original gravity, your starting gravity. Then if your yeast does its job well, you'll get good attenuation, so you'll have a higher alcohol by volume. So I hope that answers Norm's question. Reading questions like that just reminds me how confusing all this stuff was when I was first starting brewing. But now, you know, we just take all this stuff for granted. We take it for granted that everybody knows what we're talking about. But every now and then, we need to back up and cover some basics to make sure everybody's on the same page. So I hope that helped. Don't be afraid to, you know, send me a question. If you hear us talking about stuff on here and you're like, what? What does that mean? Drop me a line and remind me that we need to make sure that everybody's getting the information and understanding it. Now, if you've seen this week's Basic Brewing video, you've already seen Andy's cool new toy, an 8-gallon bourbon barrel. Well, a few days ago, Andy and I sat down on his deck to talk about what he's planning to put into it first.
What kind of noise is that?
Well, that's you wrapping your fingers on an oak barrel.
It's a little oak barrel. It's here. So we're out here. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio again. Andy Sparks, owner of thehomebrewery.com. We're out here on your deck, and we're looking at a barrel, and it's a moderately sized barrel sitting on your table here. How big is this barrel?
Well, thanks for having me, James. This thing is about 8 gallons. Probably several of your listeners may have seen the ads for these on the AHA website and some of the emails that they've sent out recently. There was an ad for small oak barrels from a place called Woodinville Whiskey Company. I think they're out of Washington. And so I went ahead and ordered one. And we got it... 2 or 3 days after ordering it, so pretty quickly. Smells absolutely delicious. It is just a little small barrel, like I said, about 8 gallons. So, you know, it's going to have a lot more oak to, you know, to volume ratio. So, you know, whereas a big 60-gallon barrel, you know, would have a certain amount of oak, you know, to, you know, to volume ratio, this has quite a bit more. I think it's about four times more.
Wow. So we looked online at the website, the Black Swan Cooperage, who made the barrel. And inside, it's not just smooth staves. It's got some interesting stuff going on.
Right. So the folks at the Black Swan Cooperage, what they do is that it looks like they drill some of the staves with small holes, and then the other staves are cut with kind of slashes in them. And they kind of, this is in an alternating pattern inside the barrel, and this is meant to help add increased surface area for the whiskey that's matured in it to give it lots of extraction. But that should play in our hands as well.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that we're going to have to worry about a little bit with this guy, because of that surface area and, you know, these kind of methods that they've used, with the holes and stuff, you know, we probably going to want to really be careful, especially on this first beer that we put in here, you know, to maybe not let it sit in there very long at all, you know. So one of the things that we're going to do, I think, to help us with that, in an effort to be able to take samples regularly, one of the things that I noticed when I was at the Avery Brewery is that several of their oak barrels actually have a small nail in the end of the barrel. And they can actually go up to those with a pair of pliers and pull the nail out and take a little sample and then stick the nail back in. And apparently this is a technique that Vinny Treluzzo started out at Russian River. I'm not sure, maybe he picked it up from somebody else, but you know, I think that's where most of these guys have picked it up from. So anyway, we've picked up some of those little nails.
And these aren't just ordinary house nails.
This is true. These are these are stainless nails. So I actually contacted a friend of mine at Avery and asked what size nail they used. My buddy Wad there hooked me up with some 4D. He basically told me what size they are. 4D nails, and I think the drill bit you use is a 7/32, but I'm not sure. I can double check that. I think the last time we talked to Michael Tonsmeyer, who also, you know, obviously specializes in the use of oak barrels, and I think they do this as well. They use the nail trick as well, and he was saying that I think they found that it works best to drill the hole after the keg is actually filled, which is kind of counterintuitive. You might think that, you know, you run the risk of, you know, electrocuting yourself or something like that. I'll probably use a cordless drill when I do it. But I think the idea is that when you make that initial penetration of the keg or the barrel with the drill, that all the pressure is going to cause, of the liquid already being in there, is going to cause everything to come out. Thus, you're not going to have very little chance of actually, you know, causing some sort of infection when you do this. And it also causes the little bits of oak to be spit out outward too. So, and then you just plug it with the nail.
And the reason that you're wanting to do that is because you don't want the beer that we're going to put in there to be over oaked. And I would assume that in over-oaking, it would be extracting some more of the oak flavor from the barrel than you would want. You're wanting to use this for more than one time of getting the oak character, so it seems like that checking the beer and making sure that you don't over-oak it would kind of help the longevity of extracting the oakiness out of the barrel.
Well, that's right. You know, I mean, Part of the thing here is that because of the barrel being very small, you know, a couple things, the staves are thinner, therefore you can have the oxygen diffuses through the walls of this of the barrel more easily than a bigger cask or a bigger barrel. But also, like we said, it's got more surface area to volume, so about four times as much. So what we're going to want to do is we're going to want to be real careful. Taste it fairly regularly, and then, you know, a month and a half or 2 months, we may be ready to pull it. Now, the fact that we're going to want to take several samples also means it's probably better not to continually pull the main bung on top of the keg or the barrel, and You know, it's a much bigger hole, easier for dust and crap to fall down in there. You know, the use of the little nail trick is going to allow us to take a small sample each time and not, you know, have very little chance of adding an infection to the barrel. And yeah, the idea here is that we're going to try to use this for several batches and in essence strip that bourbon oaky character out by making a few beers where that would complement those beers. And then after that starts to fade and as the barrel loses that the kind of bourboniness, then we probably will ask Michael Tonsmeyer to send us a couple bottles of his favorite sour beer and inoculate this barrel with some of those critters. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that this barrel has that the honeycomb staves mm-hmm. inside it and all that, that's just only going to help us get those bugs kind of permanently, into this barrel deep, where we can then start to do kind of a little Solera project with this, mm-hmm. like Michael's doing, but on a little smaller scale. And this is going to be nice and manageable for us. So 8 gallons, we're going to probably be able to, that's an easy size to fill up. I think our first batch, we're going to make a little bigger batch so that we'll have plenty to fill the barrel with and then some to compare oaked versus non-oaked, and maybe even do a little blending.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think if for some reason we need to top off or whatever, I think that it's always better to have more than not enough. Like you said, if it gets too oaky, we can blend back. And also we can do a comparative tasting side by side to say before and after. Here's what it was before, and here's what the effects were. Now, one more word about the nail. When we were first talking about the nail, I was envisioning putting the nail in the side of the barrel for some reason. Yeah. But, it makes more sense to put it in the end of the barrel in that circular piece of wood there at the end. And I assume that that's where everybody does it.
Right, that's right. And they actually, from what I've seen, is they put the nail slightly above half center, maybe just an inch or two above half center, so it's not right at the top, but about, 3/4 of the way down the barrel. That way you're getting it approximately from the middle of the barrel, where you're getting kind of the average flavor, I'm guessing. Mm. And also, as the angel share developed, you get some evaporation and the keg would start to lose some of that volume. If the hole was too high, you might not be able to pull a sample, after that. So, but like you said, we're going to make a little extra, so we're going to be able to top up that angel share if evaporation becomes a problem. I don't really expect that because I don't expect to leave the beer in this thing very long,
yeah,
especially these first couple shots.
Yeah, and talking about the location of the nail, if you're going to put it at the bottom, it seems like there would be more pressure coming out as well, and you want kind of a manageable amount of pressure coming out. Now the beer that you're going to design, and I'm going to hopefully help you brew, is going to be fermented in a more traditional fermenter, primary fermentation, right?
Right, I'm going to use my cylinder conical stainless fermenter. I have a 14 and a half gallon stainless fermenter, so we're gonna ferment in that. And I think the plan is we're going to make a beer, and we're going to try to ferment about 12 and a half gallons, and that'll give us a solid 8 gallons into the barrel with about 4 gallons left over, to top up with or blend with or use for comparison's sake.
So. It's kind of this is our first barrel to actually play with, and there's so many interesting so much potential that we got here. So when you're wanting to do a beer for a barrel, you want to have something that will hold up to the flavors of the leftover bourbon, or maybe actually we should, before we get into that. You were a bit concerned about the barrel drying out. So before we started recording, you actually did something to kind of prep the barrel and to keep it fresh a bit.
Well, yeah, that's right. One of the things that I was a little worried about is letting it get really dry, and I don't think it is. I mean, it smells very fresh and very... It smells delicious. Mm-hmm. Lots of coconut and vanilla aromas coming from the barrel. And when we got it, it still feels heavy, like it's still damp from the bourbon. But there was no bourbon in it. There was not a little bit sloshing around the bottom at all. And unfortunately, we're not able to brew, or we don't have the beer ready to go right in it. So what we've done is we've gone ahead and taken a bottle of bourbon, Maker's Mark, I think is what we used, and we've just gone ahead and put it inside there, put the bung back in, wrapped it a couple times with the hammer, and sloshed it around in there good. I don't think it'll hurt the bourbon any. we'll drain all that back out and put it back in the bottle, and it may give it a little, the Maker's Mark, a little extra bourbon or a little extra wood character. I just didn't want to leave it dry the whole time, because it's going to be, let's see, if we brew next week, that would be Sunday maybe, and then another 2 weeks in the stainless, and then, so we're 3 weeks out probably.
Mm-hmm. And you've had it for a week already.
Right, so a month, that's getting to the point where I really kind of start to get a little nervous. Probably don't need to be, but better safe than sorry. So what I'll do is I'll slosh this thing around, every couple days, just kind of keep it damp on the inside with the bourbon, and then dump it out the day before we brew, probably, and or the day before we fill it.
Yeah. So. Now, what style did you settle on?
Well, I went back and forth a few times. I wanted something big, something that would complement the vanilla and coconut or the bourbony flavors that this barrel seems to have. So I ended up deciding on a Russian Imperial Stout. It seems like a good way to go for the first one. It should be able to take a lot of that kind of bourbon character and oaky character without too much trouble. So that's the one we're going to go with.
You wouldn't want to do a lighter beer, like an oaked Belgian wit probably wouldn't be too good. That would probably clash a lot with the flavors. And
especially with the bourbon flavors, right? I don't, what's going to go good with those? Well, probably the roasty, chocolatey flavors of a stout. I can see really being complimentary to it. And, I'm not inventing anything here. There's plenty of examples of bourbon aged beers out there, bourbon barrel aged beers. Lots of them are, Russian Imperial Stouts. A few of them are big barley wines. That's another good one. A couple things you're going to want to probably think about is that you probably want a fairly hoppy beer, in the sense that you want a beer that has enough bitterness. Because that's also going to be an inhibitor of, anything getting in there and infecting the beer. When we talked to Michael Tonsmeyer the last time, I suggested maybe a Scottish Wee Heavy, and he was thinking that maybe, a beer that was highly malty and sweet with very little hop bitterness might not be a great thing, even though it might be, the bourboniness might be complimentary on that beer. The fact that you're putting a real malt bomb in there without a lot of bitterness, maybe not the best way to go. Maybe better, maybe the second beer or something like that. So anyway, we've decided on a Russian Imperial Stout with about 70 IBUs.
Yeah, you got to think of India Pale Ale when it was first brewed. The legend has it that they were put in barrels and shipped across halfway around the world, and that the higher bitterness of that style helped to preserve the beer. So, if it worked for them, it ought to work for us.
That's true, and that's an interesting one to do, and maybe we should try that next. I don't think they were actually, obviously they weren't shipped in Kentucky bourbon barrels to India.
That's true.
They were in probably fresh oak barrels, so they would have a much more intense oakiness. Which is not something that we normally see in India Pale Ale today. It's not considered an oaked style of beer, and most of the IPAs today tend to be very hop aroma driven, which is not normally something that we would, really. That's not going to be necessarily easy to pull off in an oaked barrel.
We're being surveilled by the feds, apparently.
They come by once a week or so.
These are just hops, I swear.
It does look like the black helicopter, doesn't it?
There are no markings on that helicopter. and it's leaving a contrail. I don't understand. No, but yeah, this big, high alcohol, highly hoppy imperial stout will have a lot. It preserves on two fronts. It has a higher hoppiness, a higher bitterness, and it has higher alcohol as well. So we should be in good shape as far as, because it's not only for this batch, since you're wanting to reuse the barrel over and over again, we don't want to get it to be too crazy in the beginning. Eventually you're going to throw some bugs in there and have some sourness and some funkiness, but on these first at least couple of beers you want it to be nice and fresh and sort of straight.
Exactly.
So talk about what you're not just doing a Russian Imperial Stout. You're adding some an adjunct in there as well.
That's right. You know, before I got the barrel, and before I decided even saw the ad for the barrel, I was kind of thinking I'd like to try to do an oatmeal stout, and so that's part of the reason that this is kind of, you know, played into this for me. I've been eating a lot of steel-cut oatmeal for breakfast. Steel-cut oats, a little different than your normal, you know, quick oats or your instant oats that you get in the store. And I find them to be very, very flavorful and quite creamy and delicious. And my technique for cooking them has been to just cook them overnight in a slow cooker. And in the morning, it is completely gooey and gelatinous and looks like it would be ideal for pitching into a mash tun. So I've been thinking I really ought to do an oatmeal stout where I basically cook the oatmeal for the night before, basically overnight in a slow cooker, get it good and mushy and ready for the mash tun, and then just mix that into my mash tun, you know, the next morning and proceed to brew a big fat oatmeal stout.
Mm-hmm. Now, alternatively, you could either get rolled oats, which are ready for the heat from rolling them, gelatinizes those starches and gets them ready for the mash tun right away. Or you could do a cereal mash and do some, you know, boil, actually do a step mash, a small step mash with some six row or a highly a malt with a high diastatic power and actually just boil that cereal mash. But it seems like to me that this should work. I mean, this seems like it would, it's a lot simpler because what you're wanting to do is you're wanting to make those starches available for the enzymes in the mash to break down. And if you cook this stuff overnight, it should be nice and gooey and gelatinous and ready for those enzymes to chomp away and break down those starches into sugars and to get ready for the yeast.
Well, that's my hope anyway. So yeah, the idea is that I'll probably prep the oats the night before, get them all ready, and then cook them overnight, and then have them ready to go in the morning when I wake up and fire up the hot liquor tank. We should have the adjuncts ready to be included into the recipe.
Are you worried at all about the mash getting too sticky with the oats in there?
Yeah, I am a little bit. I'm not too worried. I plan to add some rice hulls. You know, they're inexpensive and they work good to replace the husk material that's not present in the in the oats. So I'll throw some of those in there, and I'll be honest, I don't have much issue with stuck mashes. With my mash tun, it doesn't really get stuck, so I haven't had too much worries.
Knock on that wooden barrel, will you? Knock wood. So talk about your recipe. We're making it 12.5 gallons. What do we got going on here?
Okay, so to end up with 12.5 gallons, so the idea is that we'll have, you know, 8 for the fermenter and 4 left over. I'm going to start with about 15.5 gallons of water into the kettle. So that's what we're going to try and collect from the mash tun. So what we're going to do is we're going to probably use, and I'm kind of going back and forth on this, but I'm going to use a bunch of two-row pale malt. Right now it's looking like about 28 pounds. Probably use about 4.5 pounds of light dry extract. You know, my mash tun is a converted keg, so it tops out in the neighborhood. It's really unmanageable to push it all the way to the limit, so it tops out in the neighborhood of 12.5 gallons worth of capacity for the mash tun. So that's really pushing it. At this point, I've got about, 36 pounds of grains that are going to be in the mash tun. So a couple things that we've thought about doing is moving some of the dark grains, like the roasted barley and the debittered black malt, and do them in a steeping grain fashion. That basically reduces how much I have to get into the mash tun. So we're looking at about 28 pounds of British two-row, 4.5 pounds of light dry extract, 4 pounds of roasted barley, a couple pounds of debittered black malt, 3 pounds of the steel-cut oats. So that's our our bill for our grist and the fermentables. And then, you know, for the hopping, we want a fairly firm hopping. We want it fairly bitter, right? You know, the range on Imperial Stouts is anywhere from around 50 to 90 IBUs. I don't want this to be a beer that is dominated by bitterness. You know, it really wants to be fairly sweet. You know, so that we are tasting some of those sweet coconut and vanilla flavors. But on the other hand, if it was to be way at the low end of the bitterness, I'm afraid it would be too kind of sticky, gloppy sweet and kind of cloyingly sweet. So I want it kind of in the middle somewhere. So we're going to shoot for about 70 IBUs. To get that in this 15-gallon volume in the brew kettle, we're going to add 2.5 ounces of Warrior. There's 16% alpha acid, so big hop bitterness punch. But we're going to boil those early in the boil, boil them for 60 minutes. And then at about 45 minutes, we're going to add a couple ounces of Fuggles. And that's going to kind of drive that bitterness just a hair higher. It would have been in the 50, 55 range without that. So that kicks it up to about 70. And that should give us, you know, if there's any real flavor from the hops, you know, that should come from those more than the Warriors. Which would give us more of that English thing. I think the Warriors have a nice clean bitterness, and so being early in the bitterness, we're not going to get a ton of flavor for them anyway. I think they'll be good to go for a nice, you know, bittering hop that we don't have to add a whole bunch of to get this big bitter beer bittered.
We're looking at original gravity of 1.101, with a terminal gravity of 1025. So, you know, that leads to your point that you don't want it to be too, you want to emphasize the hops, because without a proper hop balance, that is going to be a sweet beer, because that's, you know, that's a session beer almost, starting gravity right there at 1025. So it's pretty exciting. And what yeast are you looking at?
You know, we've kind of gone back and forth. I did spend a good bit of time in Ray Daniels' book, Designing Great Beers, in the Stout chapter. And that's one of the things I do a lot when I get ready to brew a beer, is I go back to that book. I think it's a good kind of primer. You know, when you're looking to do a style, it's good to kind of get your feet, you know, kind of grounded, and also kind of, you know, reread that stuff. And, you know, he talks about the yeast, and, you know, a lot of the beers use the Irish ale yeast. It's kind of the go-to yeast for stouts. But this is going to be a big, high-gravity stout. The Irish ale yeast, slightly less attenuative. We probably need the extra attenuation of the American ale yeast. That tends to be the two that people use. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for ease's sake, we're probably just going to go with the SAFFA 05. That way we can throw plenty of yeast at it and get it cranked up fast. That's what we're going to use.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I mean, we've had good success with the SAFFA US 05, and there's no reason to doubt that it wouldn't do a good job on this one as well. And, it, you know, this style is not all about the yeast, especially with the barrel. involved in the bourbon flavor and the oak flavors. I wouldn't think that you'd want an estery yeast to be competing with that.
Right. I agree. You know, it's funny. One of the things that Ray points out in his book in the stout chapter is that, you know, a basic stout, which should be something that any home brewer should have in his hip pocket, you know, and be able to brew at any minute if they need to, is a very simple beer in its essence. It's, you know, a malt bill of mainly, you know, British pale ale malt, at about 90% with roasted barley in the neighborhood of 10% and not much else. Mm. You can pretty much ferment it with any yeast, and come out with a pretty decent beer as long as you know what you're doing in as far as home brewing goes. And so that's kind of was our guiding, you know, idea when we were trying to brew this, not to make it too full of other things, even though we've added the oats. So pretty much it's just roasted barley and two row. I did add a little bit of the black malt, the debittered black malt, only to drive the color to the black, you know, into the black more, so that it would look a little more appropriate. But
and you discussed briefly of adding some sugar to the recipe as well.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple references to sugar in some of the stout recipes that I've looked at. We are adding a bunch of, you know, 4.5 pounds of light dry extract, and that's just in essence to help us kind of minimize the how much malt goes into the mash tun. And, you know, I could substitute some of that for, let's say, brown sugar or some sort of candy sugar or something like that. I don't know. I mean, at this point, I think we've got enough fermentables. You know, that would tend to make it a little drier and mm-hmm. crisper. Mm-hmm. What I don't want to end up with is a beer with a thin alcoholy finish.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that's going to be a problem at this point with the, you know, the terminal gravity looking fairly high at this point. On the other hand, if I had substituted a bunch of table sugar or brown sugar even, you know, that might dry the beer down, you know, lower, down towards the, you know, let's say 10-18 or, you know, something like that. And I don't know if that's what I really was looking for.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, with the bourbon flavors, I think it's going to be going to have plenty of an alcohol character. I don't think you're going to need a lot of help with that.
Right. I think we're going to want some of that kind of sweetness from some residual sugars and carbohydrates.
Designing great beers, I mean, that we've talked, it's been a while since I've talked about that book. That it wasn't until I read that book that I felt confident in actually coming up with recipes from scratch. Up until that point, I was either buying kits, you know, ingredient kits from you, but then you sold me this book, and or going online and finding recipes and kind of, you know, using those as a starting point. But the one thing that this book does, the Designing Great Beers does, is it talks, it doesn't just say, here's the recipe for a stout.
Exactly.
It says, these are results from homebrew competitions. This percentage of people used this. This percentage of people used that. Some people use this. Some people use that. You might want to do this. You might want to do that. Right. And it kind of gives you the tools to make your own decisions toward, you know, toward building those recipes. It's not a, this is the way you do it, boom. It's a, this is the way you might want to do it. And so I love that. I love that that style of writing where it kind of leaves the door open for you to add your own creativity in there.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite books. And like you say, he does a good job, you know, for each style that he covers, basically, like stout. He'll give you some history, and he'll talk about the different differences between the styles and so forth and what makes a stout a stout. And then he goes into, you know, some of the commercial styles and what makes them different and kind of what goes into them. And then he talks about, you know, because if a beer can make it to the second round of the NHA, it's probably a pretty darn good representation of that style. And so he then takes some statistics from that and says, okay, yeah, you know, the ones that win and the ones that do well, they're not, you know, as he points out in here, kitchen sink stouts, you know, stout with, you know, four times of different types of crystal malt and roasted barley and chocolate malt and black patent and, you know, every different type of dark grain. You know, they tend to be, the winners tend to be fairly simple. Mm. And even the commercial styles tend to not have a whole bunch of different stuff in them. They tend to be fairly simple recipes.
Yeah, I think there's two reasons for that. Probably you don't want to muddy up your recipe. You know, when you're cooking something, sometimes the simple flavors, well combined, are really nice. On the second side of that, for a commercial brewer, the fewer ingredients they've got to stock, the less space that they got to take up in their warehouse, and you know, some more simple recipes make for a more efficient operation, you know, commercially. But it works. Well, I'm excited. We'll keep everybody updated on what actually transpires. I mean, I wanted to get together with you to sort of track this project from the very beginning and kind of get the thought behind the process, and I can't wait to actually get going and finally get something in this barrel, and then we'll be looking forward to the next one, and then hopefully, you know, we can keep this rolling to where as soon as the beer is racked out of this one to begin with, the next beer is ready to just go right in.
Exactly right. I really, you know, I'm looking forward to, you know, doing this little project with you, and getting to share it with the listeners and everything. And so I think, you know, we've started out, we've kind of laid out the plans for the recipe and what we intend to do with the barrel. And then, you know, hopefully we'll get some video episodes where we maybe make the batch of beer and actually put it into the barrel so you can see what the barrel looks like and see that. And then, you know, a tasting at the end, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's the part I look forward to most. Well, thanks, Andy. It's a beautiful day. Got all the birds in the background and the military helicopters and. Well, this is good. I'm so excited, and I'm glad that you saw that ad and took the plunge.
Well, you know, me too. And but the kind of fun thing is that, you know, I saw the ad and I. You know, I emailed you about it, I think, and we talked a little bit about the idea of doing it, and I kind of impulsively just pulled the trigger. you know, it was a kind of a little bit of a rash decision, and the next day I looked, and they were out of barrels.
Yeah.
So, and it was probably a good thing that I went ahead and took the plunge. It's a pretty expensive little barrel. It's probably more than most, you know, people would think is a real good price for a barrel. But on the other hand, you know, it's here, it's sitting on the table, and we're going to brew in it, and, you know, I look forward to it, too.
Yeah, I think it's good. I think if we can get many uses out of it, I think that makes it well worth the price. And I think, we were talking to the Fayetteville Lovers of Pure Suds, the Flops group, the other night about getting a 60-gallon barrel and talking about the logistics of how to do that and how to get the people together and how the equipment that was needed and all that. And it's really, it's an undertaking. But this, not so much. We can do this.
This is manageable. We'll knock this out.
All right. Thanks, Andy.
No problem, James.
Well, thanks again to Andy. We're planning on brewing very soon. And we'll keep you posted through this podcast and the video podcast to let you know how it all turns out, and I can't wait. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site, along with our Brewer's Logbook. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Brinno TLC 100 Time Lapse HD Video Camera and Corsa 14111 Stainless Steel Pro Series 3.5-inch Sport Exhaust System. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what unless you tell me. So no worries. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget, you can also join the American Home Brewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on BasicBrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.